Jim Stone has served as Massachusetts Insurance Commissioner from 1975 to 1979, and then as Chairman and Commissioner of the U.S. Commodities Futures Trading Commission for 4 years. He's currently the founder, chairman, and CEO of the Plymouth Rock Group of Companies, and Mr. Stone is the author of 5 Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Greatest Economic Challenges, and he joins me today to discuss his book and the upcoming election. Hey, Jim, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
So your 5 Easy Theses address, number one, fiscal responsibility or fiscal balance, the inequality that we're seeing today, healthcare, education, and financial sector reform. And these are, in your view, the most pressing issues facing our country today. Let's begin with fiscal policy. And just before I ask the first question, let me describe or define the word fiscal here. So there are two types of federal policy aimed at steering the economy one way or the other. The first is monetary policy, which is the result of the Federal Reserve's action manipulating interest rates or the money supply. And then there's fiscal policy, which is really the product of governmental spending managed by Congress. Now, Jim, you write about fiscal balance as one of those 5 most pressing issues. Is addressing the deficit part of this fiscal balance you're speaking of?
Absolutely. In fact, that's really the core of what I have to say. But if I may interject something,
please do.
I didn't really want people to come away thinking these are the 5 most important issues of all, because there are foreign policy issues that I'm not expert in that are also really important. And there are some domestic issues that are really important that I don't have answers to, some environmental issues in particular. So these are 5 that are, I would say, you know, in the top 10, but they're 5 that have answers.
Okay.
And that's why I call the book 5 Easy Theses. I could write a book called 5 Difficult Theses, but I wouldn't have any answers.
I got you. So this is the stuff that's in your wheelhouse. This is the stuff you've been thinking about, you've been researching. So let's talk about the deficit as the first fiscal priority.
Sure. So there's really 2 kinds of deficits. So there's a short-term one, which is the one that everybody looks at. That's the one that adds to the national debt, and that's the one that, you know, we call the deficit. And then there's kind of a long-term one in the sense that it's going to be really expensive to meet what we've promised seniors, and we haven't provided for it. Social Security really needs mending. So those have different kinds of answers, in my opinion. As you said, the deficit is a matter of how much Congress appropriates and how much it taxes and how those 2 match up. And my argument here is that there's a lot of attention to spending and spending cuts, a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Appropriations get scrutinized. But what doesn't get scrutinized is all the tax breaks we give.
Mm-hmm.
And we give tax breaks. You know, there were tobacco subsidies until recently. There's subsidies for life insurance. There's subsidies for oil drilling. But the ones that I concentrate on, because they are, in fact, popular, but I think misplaced in judgment, are the interest deductions.
Well, why do you say that? Now, how much effect will an elimination of getting a deduction on the interest on your mortgage or corporations being able to deduct the interest on their loans? I mean, is that really going to make a dent?
That's the perfect setup question, because if you add up what the home mortgage deduction and the corporate interest deduction cost, it's just about exactly equal to the whole deficit.
Wow.
If we got rid of those 2 things, we would not be running deficits. And they're not valuable. The home mortgage interest deduction is loved, and people are really happy to have it. But the truth is, it doesn't help the whole bottom third of the population because they're renters.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't help the next third because you have to itemize deductions, and the next third doesn't itemize deductions. So it only helps the top third, and it helps them in proportion to how big a house they have.
Mm.
We're moving money from less prosperous people to more prosperous people. That's kind of dumb.
Other countries have eliminated the interest tax deduction too, and I don't think it's really been much of a problem for that. You know, you talked about these short-term deficits versus the long-term idea or the long-term IOUs that we're adopting for ourselves. Well, federal spending, according to your writing, is, you know, 3/4 of that is for defense, the elderly, which I guess you're talking about Medicare and Social Security, and debt service. Let's take a look at that third rail, that Social Security entitlement,
yeah,
and so on. So are the candidates addressing that issue? How are they addressing that issue?
In general, I would say that Secretary Clinton has not wanted to address issues where you're taking away any kind of benefit. She may have to do that as president, but during the campaign, she's not said anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Trump has suggested cutting taxes for the wealthy, which I think is probably going in the wrong direction. It would increase the deficit.
Well, the cutting taxes for the wealthy, I mean, he's come up with three basic tax rates and also some benefits. I think he just wants to cut taxes overall. But of course, since the wealthy pay most of the taxes, you have the greatest benefit to them. But what is he saying about Social Security? Anything in particular?
So, yeah, I think neither candidate has taken on the Social Security issue. And maybe I don't blame them during a campaign.
Yeah, I wouldn't either, right.
But one of them is going to be president, and I certainly would want them to do it then.
So what are some of the cures for this tremendous entitlement program that everybody values so much?
Well, it has a simple solution. It's just a piece of medicine that nobody wants to take. And that is that at the time Social Security was created and they debated what the eligibility retirement age should be, they came up, you know, with 65. But the fact is, people only lived into their 60s then. Now the average person lives to be about 80. And if we make progress in solving cancer, people will live routinely to be 90.
Mm-hmm.
And we just can't afford to pay for people for that long under the current structure. And so I think that inevitably we're going to be raising the eligibility age.
Mm-hmm.
And the sooner we do it, the more gently we can do it. But the fact is, 65 isn't what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to have to do that. And the metaphor I use is now we're a speeding car headed towards a brick wall. And my friends in Congress tell me until people panic and realize the wall's right ahead
yes.
of them, nobody's going to want to fix it. And I say, yeah, well, then it's going to hurt. But if we fix it now, it's not going to hurt much.
Yeah, well, you know, the red light always gets put in at the intersection after there's terrible accidents and some deaths. They never put it in at these terrible intersections beforehand to prevent them. And I think Congress is the exact same way. They're going to be pushed up against the wall before they make any changes. Now, there have been some changes made. I mean, the age where you can collect Social Security has been rising from years ago. It has risen, I should say. But you think it should
yes,
rise more?
It was adjusted up once,
yeah.
But not anything like.
Well, what do you think it should be?
What the difference is, oh, I think that the Social Security trust fund trustees laid out pretty well what it ought to be, that it's got to gradually rise about 5 years, but gradually rise another 5 years. But if we make huge progress in extending average life expectancies, then it has to rise more because they didn't take into account the fact that people may live far longer than the mortality tables show today.
My guest is Jim Stone. He is the author of Five Easy Theses. I guess a play on five easy pieces, right?
It is. It is.
Common Sense Solutions to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. We've been talking about the budget deficit. Let's move to healthcare, because healthcare
sure.
is on everybody's mind. There's a lot of issues around, especially these days, because I think of the election, pharmaceutical, you know, drugs and the rising cost of pharmaceuticals, which is real, by the way. But, you know, let's talk about what the candidates want. What is Hillary proposing and what is Trump proposing with regards to healthcare?
Yeah. Well, both of them have said something that is constructive. I think they mean it, but I don't know whether Congress will go along. We are probably the only country in the world that seems to have as its policy to make pharmaceutical prices as high as possible instead of as low as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And both candidates have suggested that they would allow the government to use its purchasing power to push down pharmaceutical costs. That would be a really good thing to do, because that's one of the four or five things that causes us to way overspend on health care. And let me just in one sentence tell you that no other developed nation in the world spends more than about 10% of GNP on health care. We spend 18%.
Mm-hmm.
That's more than $1 trillion a year. And we don't need to spend it because we don't get any better results. We are not able to show that we get better infant mortality, better life expectancy, better healthy lifespan, better obesity. We don't get better anything, but we spend over $1 trillion a year more than we have to. Pharmaceuticals are a big piece of it.
I think one of the worries is that if you take away the incentive, the profit incentive from drug companies, then you take away a lot of the impetus that has created amazing drugs that are curing people, keeping people alive. You said you think that there's a possible, you know, cure for many cancers coming our way very soon. You know, these drug companies have the profit motive, they have the capital because of shareholders. If you go into a system where you're now controlling prices, you're really, in a sense, making them a utility. And, you know, I just wonder if we're going to lose some of this miraculous stuff.
You don't have to go that far. Using the purchasing power is something that every other developed nation does as a practical matter in the area that you're talking about. We are paying for the research that benefits every other developed country. So we're paying for the research that benefits China. We're paying for the research that benefits Europe. And those costs ought to be shared. And we don't have to have patents run as long as they do. It's not that we ought to go sort of all the way in the other direction. It's that we've gone much too far in the direction of encouraging high pharma prices.
Now, Jim, you take a pretty radical position when you say that you think that we should be under a single payer system, and truly a nationalized health program. I know that a lot of people would applaud that. Other people would really decry that. Can you explain your reasoning for that?
Sure. But it's probably not as radical as it might sound the way you summarized it, because I'm not suggesting that the government supply health care. I don't want the government to take over health care. What I want the government to do is to administer it so that there aren't different kinds of paperwork for every different insurer and every different program. I don't want there to be sales costs. We spend 20% of all the healthcare dollars on marketing and administration. Mm-hmm. Other nations spend 2 or 3%. That's what Medicare costs, 2%. Social Security costs 1%. It's not medical, but we don't have to spend this 20% to have different forms and advertisements and all these things that cost money that aren't providing better health. That's all I want to centralize, not the provision of health care.
Okay, well, that's a pretty big difference than what I was saying initially. So good, I'm glad you explained that. Let's talk about income inequality, because you make some interesting points.
Sure.
You know, first of all, you know, the basic discussion today is that the fruits of our recent economic growth have virtually all been taken up by the top 0.1% of the population. But you say really the inequality isn't income inequality, it's asset inequality. Can you explain that?
Sure. Wealth inequality is much more unfairly distributed than income. The wealth numbers are really striking. It really appears that in the last 40 years, the United States created more wealth than any other country in the history of the world in that time period. And all of it went to the top decile. Mm-hmm. And wealth is more important than income. And so I think that until we do something about that, we are running the danger that we're doing exactly what the founding fathers would not have wanted us to do. You got to be very wary when anyone tries to channel the founding fathers, but I'm going to do that anyway. I'm going to do it anyway and say, I know they didn't want a hereditary aristocracy. And that's what you get if all the wealth is in a couple of percentile.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what you're suggesting, and you know, I'm sorry to use this word radical again, but this sounds radical to me. You want to tax, or you believe it would be proper to tax unrealized gains. Now, just for my listeners' sake, you know, when you buy a stock for $10 and you hold it and it goes to 15, you don't have to pay taxes until you sell it. Selling it would be a realized capital gain. An unrealized gain means that somehow you are going to be taxed from it even when you haven't made a transaction. How does that work?
Yeah, a number of countries do it. And it is, in some sense, a big leap. And so the word radical fits better there than when we were talking about healthcare.
Okay.
But I would say that, you know, the income tax seemed like a big leap at the time. And now people are used to the concept. If you don't want all the wealth to go to a very small percentage of the population, You either have to tax it as it is being accumulated or at death. And I'm in favor of trying to do both, because I really believe that what made America a great country was social mobility, the ability to have a strong middle class, and if all the money flows to the top, we won't have those things.
There is an argument, and I think it's a reasonable argument, that states that the inheritance tax itself is a double tax. You pay taxes on your money as you're earning it, as you're saving it, and even in tax-deferred accounts like IRAs, you're required to distribute it and pay taxes. So you've already paid the tax on that money, and then at death, you're paying the tax once again. What is your argument against that idea?
Sure, that's a pretty simple argument. If the tax rate were high enough the first time you pay, you don't need to tax a second time. But if you have lower tax rates in the beginning, and you still see wealth accumulating to the point that we're going to be rewarding bloodlines instead of merit, Well, then you got to tax again. And while in a perfect world, you don't ever want to double tax, it's better than having a financial aristocracy.
My guest, Jim Stone. The book is Five Easy Theses, Common Sense Solutions to America's Greatest Economic Challenges. I definitely recommend this book for all of us to get a very good idea of what the common challenges are that we all face and some pretty reasonable solutions. Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
I enjoyed being with you. Thanks.